This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
When Bill asked me to do something, Bill asked me to do something that would be provocative. And I thought what I would do is, if there's anything the IDPF is known for, it's the EPUB standard. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about life after the EPUB, which in some respects kind of sucks for publishers. Because you only just got started embracing it and building workflows and systems to allow you to sell digital downloads, and now proposing that you think about the world after them. And the fundamental reason behind that, though, I think requires that we go back a little bit in time, even before the time of anyone on the panel and before Seth Godin's time, to a world that, you know, Seth described pertained 25 years ago when there weren't enough books. And in 1950, there weren't enough books. There was only 8,000. And then over the course of 40 years, due, I think, in large part to the social interventions. In 1950, publishing consisted of white men in tweed jackets publishing each other. It looked much like Mad Men, except they were less well-dressed. It was not a place for women or blacks or Jews, except in very small numbers. But due to the relative diminution of racism, sexism, and various forms of bigotry in the United States over the last 40 years, especially the GI Bill dramatically expanding access to tertiary education, the availability of intellectual and indeed actual financial capital required to contemplate and execute 7,500,000 word narratives and analyses became more broadly distributed. And so you saw a fairly significant increase in the number of books published, more or less fourfold over the course of 40 years. And then something happened. The rate increased dramatically, almost fourfold in the space of 7 years. And then something else significant happened. The rate of growth began to slow, and slow again. So why did it slow? And what was it that happened? What I propose is that the digital publishing revolution, in fact, began quite a while ago. And that, ironically, publishing, despite perceived as being at the very end of the adopters of technology, was the first. Because the digital publishing revolution begins with Aldous PageMaker in 1985. This is the moment, the first time in the history of mass media, when a tool that would allow somebody for $6 an hour at a Kinko's could create a file, a PDF, of quality identical to that of billion-dollar corporations. It was a kind of a classic Marxist moment, almost. The means of production were put into the hands of the average person. And what happened is that independent publishing exploded, zines exploded, publishers like Soft Skull Press, which I didn't start but which I took over in 2001, began in a Kinko's in 1993 when an employee working the midnight shift, i.e. without the supervision of a manager, laid out his novel 4 to 8.5 by 11 sheet using Aldous PageMaker on a Apple II. And printed it night after night after night, chop, chop, tape bind. He had 400 books after 3 weeks. That publisher, Soft Skull, goes on to publish 50 or 60 books a year. You multiply that by thousands, and you get the explosion in publishing of print titles that happens between 1990 and 1997. And you, of course, also have the expansion in superstores that creates the shelf space allowed to sell all those. So our digital publishing revolution is actually the first in the media world. We're far from laggards. We're actually in the vanguard. And we figured out systems, just-in-time inventory, the systems of distribution of independent publishers, explosion in the retail footprint in the United States. We figured out ways to deal with an increase in SKUs that would have obliterated any other industry. Now, we're often compared, sometimes favorably, sometimes unfavorably, sometimes it's a massive pain in the ass, when we get compared to the music industry. The interesting thing about the music industry is that their digital revolution did not begin with production, but with consumption. The MP3 standard is invented 8 years after Aldous PageMaker allows anybody to create a PDF. And then about 8 years later, we get the iPod. And it is not until 2005 that the world of music has a piece of software at a price and on a platform that is affordable that allows the music industry, allows the average musician or wannabe musician or wannabe record label an equivalent level of access that existed in publishing 20 years beforehand. So we succeeded in a certain sense. We already won. We already managed the digital publishing revolution. Now, of course, we didn't. And we didn't because the revolution that we encountered over the last 27 years was just on production. And the digital consumption revolution in publishing doesn't begin until 2007 with the Kindle. Now, that's not the Kindle logo. But what there is an example of what starts to happen around revenues when consumption becomes significantly digital. And so through the model of the Apple Store, we see a music industry getting about 70 cents for each download. And without going too deeply into agency and the question of pricing of digital downloads, we see a book generating more or less 10 times that. Now, something happened in the music industry over the last few years called Spotify. It's also called Last.fm or Pandora. It's streaming. It's subscription. It's the all-you-can-eat model. It's all the songs you could plausibly want. And the Spotify is somewhat secretive about this, but generally speaking, the royalty that is paid out to content owners by Spotify each time a song is played is 0.3 cents. So what's going to happen when that happens in books? Are we going to get 3 cents a book, which would be the equivalent, 10 times what iTunes kicks out for books, or are we going to be 10 times, 100 times what the music industry would get, or would we be astonishingly lucky and somehow manage to persuade a startup that books are worth 1,000 times what a song is worth? It's probably rather unlikely. Which means that we are going to have to confront a big revenue hole that comes from a significant amount of our print sales migrating to digital. What, therefore, is digital for if it is not, in fact, going to significantly replace print revenues? And what I would like to suggest is that rather than trying to extract every last cent, every last tenth of a cent, rather than try to engage in all kinds of perversions of the problems of abundance and scarcity and elaborate constructions to modify business models in relation to the print and digital distribution infrastructure, that we focus digital on what it does best, which is discovery. Now, there are a few obvious examples of how digital does discovery. One is the social graph. And pretty much everybody in this room in marketing is in one way, shape, or form using the social graph, using the like, using Facebook. The biggest challenge you face, of course, is that there have been several hundred million likes on Facebook since this morning. It's very much like Weimar Germany. It's a very debased currency. If the supply of books, we think the supply of books has increased recently, you should see the supply of likes. So what else do we have? Well, the speaker from GigaOM earlier today pointed out Netflix. Now, he was discussing Netflix in the context of changes in their format. But obviously, Netflix is a company that has done a tremendous amount of work. My slides are getting ahead of me a little bit. Forgive me. Netflix has done a tremendous amount of work on trying to figure out how to persuade you to watch movies you don't yet know you want to watch. Right, because their business model was premised on you catching up on all the movies you always wanted to watch and never had gotten around to, but eventually you're going to watch all those movies, and then what do? You have to watch stuff you don't yet know you want to watch, and so their ratings prediction algorithm was designed to accomplish that. So that's a kind of a taste algorithm. And then flashing behind me about 45 seconds ago was a shopping cart. An icon I think everyone in this room is familiar with, the consumption algorithm. I'm not going to do much of a salesy thing, but I am going to point out that there is a fourth possibility, a company that I'm now working with called Small Demons, that is focused on something actually quite old school, which is the text of the book itself. We're indexing books for all the cultural references within them, for 250 references on average in books, to places, to people, to music, movies, TV shows, guns, drugs, cars, Doc Martens, drugs, licit and illicit, and wiring them all up together so that you get from Murakami to Hornby via Prince's Little Red Corvette, a song that appears in both of them. So if digital is for discovery, and if, as was implicitly pointed out during the panel earlier, products, selling products, picking them and hoping they hit is somewhat of a lottery, because for every 50 Shades of Grey, there are 5 million shades of losing money. What is going to fill the revenue hole? And what I would like to propose, and I'll confess, this occurred to me only a few nights ago, so I'm actually going to work a little bit from notes, which makes me tremendously nervous. I hate notes, and I hate text on a page. I feel much more comfortable improvising, but I've only got about 5 more minutes, so I'm going to work a little bit from text. If the function of digital is discovery and only 15, 20, 30% revenue, then where are we going to get revenue from? Now, a lot of publishers talk about trying to put upward pressure on pricing. And obviously, the agency model had a certain goal that had to do with preserving control over pricing. And when that scenario is put under pressure, publishers will resort frequently to the idea that we have to educate the consumer. And that is pretty much, I think, the most disastrous thing we could possibly try to do. I certainly know in my 20s, I tried to educate people to find me attractive. And it didn't work very well. Steve Jobs didn't educate consumers to find his products attractive and appealing and worth a 50 to 100% premium on something similar out there. Ralph Lauren and Coco Chanel don't educate consumers to find their products appealing and worth what they're charging for. We're not going to be able to educate consumers to find our products more valuable than they are. That is not to say that we are not on some level right. We talk again and again about what we add in terms of value, selection, developmental editorial, the quality control of copy editing and proofreading, analytics, marketing tools, packaging savvy, distribution savvy. The hassle is that each one of those individual services is not perceived by the consumer to be bundled together worth what we think it is. So perhaps what we need to do is start to disaggregate, to unbundle, not just to go from being a B2B business to a B2C business, but to cease being a vendor of products and become a provider of services. If the game is about services rather than products, then certain companies that have built enormous infrastructures for delivering cheap, low-margin product, print and digital, will suddenly find themselves in a commodity business. I know we sometimes think that bundling these up into a book is more efficient. To take the value of what we have created in editorial and marketing and quality assurance and put them together and basically pay for our staff by persuading large numbers of people to part with $9.99 to $24.99. But I'd like to propose that we unbundle that and start selling the world our services. In part because we are already doing it. Richard Sharkin already pointed out that effectively the way he looks at what Bloomsbury does is he sells his services to authors. Faber in the United Kingdom has launched Faber Academy, which is a series of creative writing classes taught by their authors that has generated, from what I can tell, about £1 million sterling for them last year. There are several billion dollars spent in the United States on creative writing classes. People talk about disrupting the publishing business. Part of what publishing can do is turn around and disrupt the MFA business. We already have publishers launching speakers bureaus. Those are things that could be scaled up using tools like Maestro Market to be able to drill down to the authors who are only worth $500 an engagement, $1,000 an engagement, as opposed to the authors that are worth $10,000 engagement. Special sales effectively is starting to become a process of creating services for non-traditional retailers in terms of repackaging physical product for them. Book Country, Penguin's experiment in building a writing community, is effectively a gateway drug to selling self-publishing services. And interestingly, what they got pushback on when they launched that was the percentages. Right? They were going to, I can't remember the details in the royalties, I think it was 70%. So they say authors get 70% of everything over $2.99, and then Smashwords is able to say we're able to offer 90%, and so on and so forth. What they also said is that we are going to provide premium services, proper book design, a proper cover. Where do publishers have brands? They have brands in the minds of authors and would-be authors. And 16 million people self-reported as engaging in creative writing in the United States in the census in 2007. That is a massive audience that does trust the publishing brand and does exhibit demand What they didn't get pushback on was the expensive prices for their services. Because when an author spends 5 years of his or her life pouring their soul out onto the page, they're not necessarily nearly as price sensitive as when they go to Amazon to buy a book. Monetizing those 16 million people by just trying to sell them books is leaving an awful lot of money on the table. So your sources of scale now shift from being just based on infrastructure to starting to leverage tools that many companies are creating, many of which are open source, that can allow you to start scalably servicing the writing-reading economy. Moodle, which is an open source platform for course management and classroom management. Marketplaces like Maestro Market, which I mentioned earlier, and Kickstarter provide alternative marketplaces for small amounts of capital, for matchmaking, supply and demand of physical presence between a writer and a group of readers. You also have analytics tools like Bookseer, all of which can be aggregated into the publisher. And then, not dissimilarly from what we're starting to see from a company like Perseus, with its bundling of marketing services within the Constellation platform, the shift to services is something that has already begun within your companies, and it has begun experimentally. And if there's, in a certain sense, one way in which I wish to disagree with most of what came before me, it is that the time for little experiments, I think, is over. I think it is time to actually think much more largely about the experiments that have been conducted over the last 5 years and start reaching some conclusions about the structure. And I submit to you, somewhat tentatively but very passionately, if I may have two opposing ideas or attitudes at the same time, that service business is what publishers are now in. We're not afraid of technology. Publishing has always been in the vanguard of technology, from the printing press to Aldus PageMaker. Hell, we wanted to do ebooks in 2000, and the consumers didn't want them. What we have failed to do is reconceptualize the business model, not failed to adopt the technology. Sell our consumers $750 classes, $1,000 covers, $75 dinners with the author. We are servants in the writing and reading economy. We are John the Baptists to 16 million Jesuses out there. Thank you. Oh.